So this Torah portion is the Torah portion of Devarim. We're beginning the fifth book of the sixth year. And this book, just a little intro before we get into some special things. This fifth book is unlike the other four books of the Torah in that it's basically a speech that Moshe was giving before he died. It's also spoken differently. The previous four books are word for word as dictated by God to Moshe. The fifth book, God has asked Moshe to take certain ideas, process them as he is a servant of God, and then speak them. So there's a very slight difference. Our sages made sure to point out that even though he did internalize and process them, it's still God speaking through his throat. That's the expression they use. So with that in mind, I'd like to give two introductions. The first introduction we'll do just on the first word of the Torah. The first word of the Torah is, let me back up for a second. How to rebuke. That is the subject that I'm going to deal with today. Simi will come in shortly and do her piece. How to rebuke. So we're going to, before we get to how to rebuke, let's just talk about an introduction about how we had to take the words of this Torah. Because if Moses is rebuking, he's also reviewing what happened. And what we want to see, page 1120, yes? What we want to see is the instruction that everything should be new to us, new to us. The Torah should never become stale. Not only we read it every year, but every day these are messages that have relevance. And that's the introduction that I'm going to give now in a very interesting way. The first two words are Eileh HaDvarim, these are the words. We say these are the words, it sounds like you're going to say something new. And very little is new in this book. There are some new additions to the laws as they're given, but basically the narratives are reviewed. So later on, the comment is made by Rashi, based on our sages, that it should be new to you every single day. So what I'd like to show you is a short video clip in which the former chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whose name you hear here from time to time with regularity, tells a very personal story about taking something that is a daily part of Jewish life, which can become totally routine, and how and why for him it is absolutely brand new every single day. And the reason I'm pointing this out is because that's really the first word, even though the Torah portion is called Devarim. There's no word Devarim in the first sentence. It's HaDevarim. Devarim, words or things, because in Judaism words are things. So these, meaning that it's new. Let's take a listen to the meaning of new. Hold on. One second, we'll get there. Ooh. How's the volume? The volume doesn't go up, I'll have to do something. Okay, that's a little too quiet. Hang on a second, please. Sorry. One minute. No, no. 1 second. Let me get the volume. Just a second. Oh, here we go. All right. And just a second. Okay, let's start again. Here we go.
שהחזרת את נשמתי מודה אני על בגד שנחת על גופי שלא יהיה לי כאן אתה שומר עליי.
Let me tell you a story about the first prayer we say every morning, מודה אני לפניך, I thank you for giving me back my soul. It happened on our honeymoon. Elena and I were traveling through Italy and we'd come to a little coastal town called Paestum, a place with Roman ruins and the sea glittering in the morning sun. The trouble was, I couldn't swim. I just never learned. But as we sat on the beach and looked out across the water, I realized that the shore must be sloping very gently indeed, because people were far out into the sea, and yet the water was only coming up to their knees. It looked safe just to walk out. And so I did. I walked to where I'd seen people standing just a few minutes before, and yes, the water was gently lapping against my knees. Then I turned around and started walking back to the shore. That's when it happened. Within a minute, I found myself out of my depth. How it happened, I'm not sure. There must have been a dip in the sand. I'd missed it on my way out, but on my way back, I walked straight into it. I tried to swim, but I failed. I kept going under. I looked around for rescue, but the other bathers were a long way away, too far to reach me, too far even to hear. Besides which, we were in Italy, and as I went under for the fifth time, I remember thinking two thoughts. What a way to begin a honeymoon, and what's the Italian for help? It's difficult to describe the panic I felt. Clearly, someone rescued me, or I wouldn't be here now, but it seemed at the time like the end. Evidently, somebody, seeing me thrashing about, swam over and brought me to the shore. He deposited me, almost unconscious, at Elaine's feet. I never found out who he was. Somewhere there is someone to whom I owe my life. It changed my life. For years afterward, I would wake in the morning knowing that but for a miracle, I wouldn't be here. Somehow, that made everything easier to bear. Every life has its difficult moments, but I never forgot that day on an Italian beach when the life I so nearly lost was given back to me. It's hard to stay depressed when you remember daily that life is a gift, which is why every morning I say with real feeling those words, Mode ani lefanecha. I thank you, living and everlasting King, for giving me back my soul in mercy. Great is your faithfulness. Thank you, God, for giving me back my life. Think about it. The very first words Jews say every day is Mode. Even before we think, we thank. That's the first rule of prayer. It's about not taking life for granted. It's a meditation on the miracle of being. We are here. We might not have been. Somehow, that makes every day a celebration.
Yeah, so that is mightily impressive. We're going to leave that here because we're going to use it again. I have to say, that's really mightily impressive. And it has... My humble opinion, more than one message. Of course, it has the message of thanks. I'm sorry, I turned off the light there. If you can turn the light, if you'd like the light. Sorry about that. But the other thing that I wanted to bring out here as it relates to us and the first word of the Torah, and I have to say that the general underpinning of everything in today's class is from the talks of the Rebbe, that Eile, these are, in other words, even though it's a repetition, it's written as if it's something brand new because it's supposed to be brand new. So I do have to say that for a lot of people, I shouldn't accuse anybody out in this room besides myself, but we have a nature in which we can see faults in other people, and sometimes we open our big mouth and say something, and the truth of the matter is sometimes something does need to be said, as we're going to see here, that Moshe came to a point right here. And he says, listen, God has told me that I'm not going to cross the Jordan. I'm going to die here. If I don't speak to them now and tell them what I think, when am I going to say it? So he had to do it. How did he do it? Did he speak fire and brimstone? This is what we're going to look at today. So I'd like to share with you a couple of anecdotes which will help us ease into this mindset. Because on the subject of newness... Again, I'm speaking just for myself, to always maintain a composure where if you have to bring up something negative, to do it in the right way, it still remains something new for me. And since the Rebbe teaches this point, I think it's something that relates to all of us. In fact, I'm going to ask you to take note of the gray box on page 1121. There's a little gray box, and it says the last word. And it says... When rebuking the Jewish people here, Moshe did not mention or even allude to their sins. Rather, in order to maintain their dignity, merely mentioned the names of the places they had sinned. See Rashi, let's stop right here for a moment. Let me call your attention to 1:21, and let's look. These are the words, because we're going to go back down to the gray box in a second. These are the words of subtle rebuke. That's straight from Rashi. That's why it's in the brackets. Which Moshe spoke to all the Jewish people at the plains of Moab on the east bank of the Jordan. He mentioned the places where they rebelled against God in the brackets. That's a commentary of Rashi. In the wilderness, in the plains of Moab, the Sea of Reeds, in the wilderness of Paran between Tophel and Lavan, Chatzerot and Dizahav. Now, the truth of the matter is, every single name as it is in the Hebrew, and the same thing in verse 2 from Horeb to Kodesh, every single name, it's, let's call it a pseudonym, even though a pseudonym is usually a pseudonym. Usually, a person writes, let's say, a book. They don't want to use their real name, or they write for a magazine, they put a fake name, a pseudonym. So, even though you don't use the word pseudonyms for things, I don't think, but here, Moshe is using allusions, hintings. Right there from the outset, where he's describing the setting, he uses hintings, because in the hint is buried certain messages. Those particular ones we're not going to get to today. We may have gone through them other years. Let's get to you back in the gray box. On the third line, fourth line, this teaches us how careful we should be not to cause distress to another person. If on occasion it proves necessary to rebuke another Jew, even for serious sins such as the ones Moshe indicated here, pause. I know you all know how to read English, but I want to be able to break in the middle and make the point. For example, one of the sins alluded to here, where it talks about gold, v'di zahav, it's referring to the golden calf. I mean, what is worse than idolatry? Right? So nevertheless, let's go back to the thing. We should nevertheless do it subtly and gently, while at the same time drawing the person close with warmth and love. So in that regard, a few anecdotes about rebuke, and then we'll do the next video clip. And then we will go into the parasha itself, and we're going to read the parasha with those kinds of glasses. It'll talk to us, as we shall see. A certain well-known giant amongst the Jewish people, I don't remember his name. It's from within the last 200 years, probably closer to 100, 150 years. Somebody, I don't know if it was, I don't think it was Rabbi Akiva Eiger, but somebody of that stature, at least so I recall the story being told, and I don't know where to look it up. He was a rov in a particular city. He was very young. So he started out in a small position. Now, Shabbos Musaf, there is a certain passage we read, it's called Ov HaRachamim, Merciful Father, in which we ask God to take care of all of the anti-Semitism and pogroms and expulsions, all those things. It was composed, just so you get an idea, during the times of the Crusades. So you understand where it says that, God says that he can forgive everything, the non-Jews can forgive him for everything except for spilling Jewish blood. A whole speech in itself. Why is everything forgivable? Well, God is a forgiving God, but Jewish blood is not forgivable. That piece. Now, there's certain weeks when we don't read it because of whatever the reasons are. So in this story, this particular Rov was asked on a particular Shabbos, so do we say over Rachamim? Right? Do we say the peace, Merciful Father? And he answered one way. And another one of the congregation who was older, and let me just digress for a second, if you've ever belonged to a formal shul with a board and whatever, you know that perhaps there's no such thing as a shul without shul politics. And there's always got to be that fellow, or two, or three. We call it in Yiddish, Oibachochem. He's a smart aleck. Right? So it's his business, because he has gray hair, to make the young rabbi look stupid. So in this particular incident, he says, what? You don't know that we don't say it this Shabbos? Da, da, da. Right? This is in public, yeah? And lo and behold, they hold a meeting, not on Shabbos, a couple of days later. We just hired this rabbi. How could you have a rabbi who doesn't know something as simple as this? They let him go. Because the way it is in board meetings, at least in shuls, maybe in business the same, sometimes you have a few loudmouths that nobody wants to start up with, and they end up dominating most of the situation. Anyway, so they let him go. Many years later, I think it was around 20 years later, he had moved to another city, a big city, don't remember its name, and he became a rov. He actually began to become famous around the world for his scholarship, for et cetera, et cetera. So once, there's a whole event happening. I don't remember if the event was in his city or it was somewhere else. And this is now 20-some years later. one of the board members, or maybe it was that one in the shul, he comes because there's this whole big event happening, and he sees, lo and behold, who is the rabbi? It's the same rabbi. And he remembers the story from this little shtetl, how he was able to, you know, just get rid of the rabbi almost soon, as soon as he got there. So everybody's speaking to this rabbi, and they comes his turn, he says, so tell me, aren't you so-and-so? Yes. Didn't you used to be a rabbi in this little shtetl in the beginning? Yes. So how did you get here? So he said, in Yiddish, der Ov HaRachmim hot mido geschickt. The Ov HaRachmim of that passage, merciful father. So he says, the merciful father sent me here, which is a play on words. That you got me booted over a mistake about saying the peace, merciful father, and at the same time it means the father in heaven. He got me from where you, right? Because you booted me out of there, look where I am today. And I say this because it's a nice story, and from what I've read, it seems like it's really a true story, not just something that a comedian figured out. But it's a nice way of saying rebuke without fire and brimstone. Story number one. Now, I do have to say that it has not always been the practice of Jewish people to be this way if they have to say something negative to somebody. In fact, there was a time prior to the Baal Shem Tov, where it was quite an accepted practice, you had preachers. Now, I hate to use that word, because in the English language, when you think preacher, you think of a priest. But the word preacher has a dictionary definition, and that definition does not belong to the Christians. I just want to be very clear. I just don't have another word to use. Meaning to say that you had certain rabbis, and they'd go around from town to town, and they were gifted with speech, and they had knowledge, and they would rebuke the people in order to enhance their Torah observance. And somehow, it became accepted practice, and when such a rabbi came by, he was accorded honor, and everybody would come, men, women, and children, I have to say. I don't know about the children, men and women would come to the shul. The Baal Shem Tov, one of the many accomplishments was to negate and undermine this process. Where would he get such an idea from? Just take a look at today's parasha, which we're going to go through, and you can see how the Rebbe, in this little gray box, where it says, it's Sichas Shabbat Parashas Devarim, right? It means a talk of the Rebbe, that little gray box. That's what the Rebbe pointed out. That is the way of Chassidus. And when a person doesn't go that way, it means that their evil inclination is taking over, or they've got training from outside the camp of Hasidic teachings. So the question you asked is, doesn't it say, and I'm going to add to what you say, Hamal bin Pnei Chaver Barabim, the one who embarrasses his fellow in public, Ein Lechelik Olam Haba, has no portion in the world to come. So of course, that's true. You know, there's something that's very powerful on this planet, a few things that all come from one root, which creates fog, and people forget these things. Which is why I started off with the video about renewal. Even though you can say it's about appreciation, which of course it is, but about new. Because here you look at the chief rabbi, what an illustrious career. He's officially retired, although he's not sitting and doing nothing. He's training other rabbis, right? But this is many, many years ago, yeah? And he's already a grandfather and all that, and it's still new to him because it's that personal. So coming back to what you said, I'd like to say as follows. When a person is angry, every non-intellectual argument to his advantage becomes logical when you're angry. When you're angry, you're right, and everyone else is wrong, and you're okay exploding. And what shall I say? All of us are guilty of anger at some point, either some more, some less, which is one of the reasons why every year we need to renew this awareness of this thing. And one other thing I want to say, there's another element, which really anger is rooted in it, and it's called ego. And ego, as I have said many times, not because I say so, but because the Hasidic teachings teach so, ego is your biggest enemy, right? So the fact that I say, just tell us, you embarrass your fellow in public, no portion of the world to come. Hey, my ego is bigger than that, in quotes. All right, so now...
One question.
Yeah. Here is a story from the time of the Baal Shem Tov, before he came out in public as the teacher of Chassidus. But he and many other Kabbalists would go around discreetly teaching certain messages. Now, it happened that in one shtetl, this story I want to say, we know is true, because there are many, many stories that people will say from the Baal Shem Tov, and the story have grown hands and feet and hair and all sorts of things that never existed in the original. Or maybe the story was just whatever. But certain books, such as stories as told by Rebbes, these are told if they're reliable, like the Rebbe, the previous Rebbe and other Rebbes, they were very, very particular to the accuracy of their stories, which they made a subject of accuracy in stories. This story is one of them, even though I'm not looking it up to say all of the details, because I figured those details are not so relevant. But this storyline is, as it happened, as told, I believe it's by the previous Rebbe, if I'm not mistaken. So at any rate, in a particular shtetl, they had had a very severe weather, meaning said they didn't have enough rain. And of course, this is before the Industrial Revolution, before imports, exports. Not enough rain, the crops don't yield. It's bad news, it's starvation, it's famine, it's all sorts of disease, death, all sorts of things in the wake. So they did what Judaism tells us to do, that they would come together in this shtetl and shul, prayer, and so on and so forth. And one week, it happens, this is the week the Baal Shem Tov shows up, and there's a whole celebration going on. This Shabbos, they're going to have a special extra meal to thank the Almighty for the rain. Finally, rain is coming, they're going to be able to have crops, they're going to be able to survive. And they're making kugels, all sorts of things. It describes in the story, like all of those details. I just want to point out, thanking God with food. It's important, right? They're going to have the, okay, so the Baal Shem Tov comes and he's, nobody knows who he is. And he sees how these simple people, such pure faith in God, and this is going to be a Shabbos of thanking the Almighty for the rain, for their survival. So now, what happens is, one of these magidim, a magid, one of these preachers that I described before, shows up. What are we going to do? So he goes to the gabba of the shul, and he says, I'm here. So this magid says, you know, this is a Shabbos of celebration, because he knew that if a magid comes, you know, it's going to be wailing and tears and all of that kind of thing and rebuking. And he was very indignant. I came here. Should I have come here for nothing? He says, I don't know, speak to the rabbi. Anyway, they speak to the rabbi, back and forth. Finally, they decide as follows. They're going to have the meal of Thanksgiving at this and this hour, after which they're going to daven mincha, this is in shul, and everybody's going to be there already for the celebration, the men and the women. And then, between mincha and ma'ariv, he's going to give his talk. Okay. And that's exactly what happens. So fast forward, celebration is over, he's now giving his talk, and he starts accusing the people. That, oh, you're not careful with this mitzvah, with that mitzvah, you know, this and that and the other. And in the narrative, it actually goes on to mention certain specifics that he says, which I won't mention. And these are simple people, meaning to say, they have total trust in God, they live religiously, but they don't know how to learn. So comes a rabbi, and he's, you know, they take it seriously. The Baal Shem Tov, who's dressed like a very simple person, he walks up in the middle of the shul to the fella, and he says, why are you taking away God's livelihood? Ooh, he got a shock there. What do you mean? So the Baal Shem Tov says to him as follows. Now here, I need you to appreciate idiom in a language that you're not used to, even if you speak Hebrew. There's a verse that we say regularly in our prayer. It's from Tehillim, V'ata Kodesh, and you, Holy One, Yoishev, who dwells to Hillel Yisrael with the praise of the Jewish people. Now, in Yiddish, not the way, at least not the way I was taught to speak it, but this, in that area, in the lexicon, in the phraseology of the Yiddish, when you talk about a person's livelihood, you're talking about mitvoz zitzter, what's he sitting on? So that's what I'm saying, to appreciate a foreign idiom. Sitting means livelihood. In other words, how do you dwell? What are you dwelling on? So dwelling, not what are you pondering, it means what's your source of sustenance. So he says to the rabbi, he says, what do you mean? It says in the verse, Ba'ato HaKodesh, and you, Holy One, Yoishev, What is his source of sustenance? Tehillas Yisrael, the praise of the Jewish people. How could you accuse the Jewish people? You're taking away God's livelihood, because God's livelihood is praising the Jewish people. So when that happened, somebody in Shul got up and he said the Kaddish after learning, which, you know, such as we do after a Mishnah, and then they moved on with the prayers. So to point out that Moshe Rabbeinu is giving rebuke here, but he's doing it gently. And before we get into the verses themselves, and we'll see some of it, we'll see certain reviewing, I'd like to show you one more video. Now, in this video, there's going to be certain phrases which maybe you're familiar, maybe you're not. And I was a sort of a split mind whether to show it or not. I decided to show it. This is a very clever young man, British. That's his accent, I can tell, because it's not a regular British accent. It's from the British Jewish neighborhood in London, okay? I'm just saying, that's how it is. And at least that's what it sounds like to me. And what he is doing in a comedic fashion, talking about, you know, amongst religious Jews, you have many different approaches. And of course, in quotes, my way is of course the best. And that's what he is addressing. And he goes through it very quickly, so you have to sort of pay attention. I just want to point out that from the establishment of the State of Israel, there's been many, many, many parties. And just in Orthodox parties, the very first election already had 13 Orthodox parties. You'd think you'd have one party for all of the Orthodox Jews. No way. So a person can think, you know, politically, it's not my department, but I'm just saying that's one of the cautions that's necessary, which is really part of this class, especially when we get religiously passionate, is to be open to somebody who's not in your square. And that is what this video clip is going to be about. Second. All right. Let's see. Hang on a second. Oh, there we go.
Within the religious community alone, there's the black hats. Of course, that needs to be clarified. There's the up hats like mine. These are the good ones. I believe in God. You know those people with the down hats? I don't know which God they're worshipping.
One second.
You see how mine goes up to heaven? So what does that imply that they're doing?
Are you able to hear it or not?
Within the religious community alone.
If you can't hear it,
there's the black hats.
I'm going to turn off the air conditioning.
Of course, that needs to be clarified. There's the up hats like mine.
Okay.
These are the good ones.
Just a second.
I believe in God.
One second.
You know those people with the down...
Okay, there you go. Now.
Within the religious community alone, there's the black hats. Of course, that needs to be clarified. There's the up hats like mine. These are the good ones. I believe in God. You know those people with the down hats? I don't know which God they're worshipping. You see how mine goes up to heaven? So what does that imply that they're doing? But we're all black kippers at the end of the day, right? But of course, I have this little thing. I've got a big grasp. I'm not going to take it off. I only have one. He's a god, they'll have two. How many do you have? You can confront that at a later time. You see how there's this little thing around the edge of my kippah? That makes me special and loved by God. You laugh. But all of us, you know, we're all from, right? And we're all brothers. All of us are black cats and black kippahs. Of course, there's the Litvaks versus the Hasidim. That's a whole different subject. Obviously, the Hasidim are better. Unless you're Litvak and we don't like the Hasidim. But both agree that they're both better than the Sfarim, for sure. But at least the Sfarim and the Litvaks, the Hasidim can agree on one thing. None of us like Chabad. Which is interesting, because Chabad actually like everybody. As long as you like the Rebbe, right? We surely have a lot to learn from them. One of the things we can learn from them is just like us, all our black hats. As long as we're all better than the wide kippers, then we have someone to look down upon, and that's the most important thing. Of course, you can bash the wide kippers with the people who have black kippers, but they knit their kippers. Terrible human beings. Special place for them in hell, no doubt. And as long as you learn Gemara all day, but Ian, I love you. You like to learn a little faster? Please leave my religion. Buddhists are over there. Worship another god at your will. But at least we all believe in God, as opposed to the Chilanim. They're not even Jewish. Now, the Chilanim love everybody. They're not as cold-minded as us, because they love everybody except the religious people. As long as you voted for BB. And you serve in the army. And you're my kind of secular Jew. We're not a little misservity, and that's problematic. So besides that, I love you as long as you're not a chutznik.
Outside Israel.
If you're a chutznik, okay, I like you as long as you're not, you know. So this goes on forever. In every community, in every shul, right now in this room, I bet there's people you don't like. I mean, everyone put up their hand, Jewish unity. I bet right now there's someone you feel awkward about being in this room with, right? Just illustrate the point. Everyone put up your hand for a second. Put up your hand straight up high. Everyone put a finger straight at the ceiling. On the count of three, point to the person you don't like. Just illustrate the point. One, two. Gutless cowards. And it breaks my heart to say this, but I bet you could. I bet you could. In this room of people coming together to find their kedusha, to find their essence, exploring, there's the people from the shul that I connect to, there's people I don't connect to. So what happened to us? What happened to us is something that our sages told us is called sinas chinim, baseless hatred. It destroyed the temple. Now, if you want to be all religious about things, the temple is this big building that stood there 2,000 years ago, and a whole building got dismantled because of sinas chinim. But the temple means the power of your God in this world. And the Gemara says very, very clearly that any generation that does not rebuild the temple, it's as if they destroyed it. And therefore, the implication the mystical writings teach us is the reason we do not have supernatural energy and clarity and vision and unity in Eretz Israel today is it's still the sinas chinim that every one of us carries within our hearts. It's blocking our soul, our revelation, our power, the destiny of the world out. That's how powerful our heart is. That's how powerful our hate is.
Okay. Wow. So, I like this piece because really it's exactly along these lines. He's trying to, really what he's doing is really he is rebuking, I'll call it, religious snobbery. But he's doing it in a way that everybody is laughing, but everybody walks away with a message. Yeah, go on.
I just want to add a side story to this, which I've heard a number of times, but I think it was sent to me this week. There was a man in Belgium who used to talk constantly against Chabad. He was a religious guy, very religious guy, but he was known to have animosity towards Chabad, towards the Rebbe. Some people have it in their mind. They just think that that's okay. Like, you know, we can talk about what you know, don't speak slander, don't speak Lashon Hara, but about Chabad, it's okay. Anyways, that's the way the guy was, and, life went on. One day, this man shows up at the Chabad house by Rabbi Slavatitsky. And he says to him, he wants to learn Chassidus. Rabbi Slavatitsky, you can imagine, was quite surprised. But someone wants to learn Chassidus, he'll teach him Chassidus. And the way we are, Chabad, we're used to people denigrating, deprecating, and eventually coming around. We just have to do our thing. Anyway, at some point while he was studying with this man, he said to him, can I just ask you, like, what happened? What made this major change? Here he used to talk negatively about Chabad, and all of a sudden you're telling me you want to learn Chassidus? He says, you're not aware, but our two children go to school together. They had like a 4 or 5-year-old girls that went to school together, and they were friends, which happens in cities where there's not that many choices of religious schools. So they both went to the same school. The girls were playing, and he said, my daughter said to your daughter, my Tati hates your Rebbe. I guess she had picked up enough stuff in the house against Chabad. And the other little girl, your daughter, says, but my Rebbe loves your Tati. And the little girl came home with it, told it to her father. He said, when I heard this, and I know you obviously didn't prep her, I said, I have to learn this Chassidus. I have to learn what it is that Chabad is learning. Because there's something obviously I'm missing if a child of yours can speak like that. So continue.
Right, I just want to add to this story. Since I personally know Rabbi Shabtai Slavatitsky, I remember him. I don't believe he ever remembers me. He came to you where I was in yeshiva, meaning I was 18, whatever it was. And I still remember the main subjects that he spoke about both times that he came. He's that impressive a person. I'm saying this because if there's anybody I could think who would raise their kids at a 4-year-old would just blurt this out just like that on the spot, it's him. In other words, this is not a made-up story, what I'm telling you is I know this father, and it fits exactly with who he is. So now that we've done the intro, let's take a look in the Chumash itself. I'm going to turn the page to 11:22, and we'll take a look at how Moshe is speaking. We already spoke about the allusions in the first page, which we just said we're not going to talk about because we've spoken about them in previous years. But it goes on to say on verse 4. If you take a look at verse 3, just glance at it, it gives you the date of when Moshe is giving this speech. Because prior to it, it is it's the location, now it's the date. And then it goes on to say, Acharei hakoto et Sichon melech ha'emori. After he, I'm paraphrasing, after he successfully went to war against this and this king and the and this other king, so on and so forth. What does Rashi tell us? Which, if you can read the Rashi, you could read it, and if not, not. But the point here is, it says, it's verse 4. So, if you're going to look into the Rashi, it's going to be six lines from the bottom of the right column of Rashi. And what does it say? Rashi says, as a simple interpretation, we have to remember, Rashi is speaking to the one who is newly introduced, the child is newly introduced to Chumash. And he's teaching as follows. If I'm going to give them rebuke, I first have to do something good for them. So it's telling the story that after he led them to war, he didn't say, oh, I'll send the office, you go. After he led them to war, then he rebuked them. So right there, we're already seeing about how rebuke goes. Then we're going to take a look at verse 5. It says, Be'ever HaYarden, Be'eretzmov, on the other side of the Yarden, meaning on the eastern side of the Yarden, land of Moab, Moshe began Be'eret HaTorah Zot, to explain this Torah. And he, the commentaries point out, the sages tell us, that he translated the Torah into 70 languages. You'll see a little gray box on 1123 at the bottom left. Translation of the Torah. Why did Moshe bother the Jewish people to listen to the Torah being translated into 7 languages? And so on. So I'm just going to skip what it says there because we've discussed that particular point in previous years. But I'd like to say it as follows. When Moshe is rebuking them, he is giving them he's giving himself a very clear vision of what their future is going to look like. There's going to become a time in the future when they are not going to be able, where many of them will not know how to study the Torah in the Hebrew. So even though English was not invented, you may know that English is a composite language of many languages, and it's very young relative to, let's say, our language and other Semitic languages. But let's just suppose we'll throw in English just because we'll take license to do that. In other words, he's translating the Torah into English so that we can sit here today and understand the Torah. He began that path. In other words, he's paying attention to what the future is going to look like, including its decline. And even though he's going to rebuke them, you could say, well, he's going to rebuke them. Just, you know, give it to them in the teeth. You know, throw the book at them, whatever expression you want to use. No, he's going to do something that is going to be helpful to them. And now, let us turn the page. And we're going to take a look at verse 9. Show you something very interesting. We're going to take a look, verse 9, 10, 11, and 12, very quickly. What does Moshe says? He says, "Va'omar alechem ba'eti lemor." At that time, I said to you the following. Now, before we go further, many, many times when you'll listen to Moshe speaking, he, instead of making his point, he will put it in the words, "This is what I said then." Why do you have to tell me you said it then? You're saying it now, say it now. Because to soften it without removing the pointedness of the point, but just to soften it, the focus is still there. He's saying, this is what I said. But now let's take a look at something even more. He says, I said to you that I just can't carry all of you. Meaning to say, I can't do this anymore. Now, the next two sentences seem to be totally out of place. He says, Hashem Kerechim here, may God multiply you. We should make you like the stars in the heavens. That's how you should be multiplied. And then he goes on to say, in verse 11, page 1126, 1127, that Hashem Kerechim, the God and God of your fathers, should increase you thousandfold and bless you as he promised you. And then he says, in verse 12, How can I handle all of your shenanigans? I'm just paraphrasing. Now, if you listen to those four sentences, you realize something's happening here. Verse 9, Moshe says, I said to myself, how can I handle you? Verse 12, he continues that thought. He then specifies why he cannot handle you. Because you have arguments and this and this and that. And then he talks about something else, which we'll get into. In the middle, he sticks in two sentences of blessing. How did that get in there? Because if you are rebuking someone out of a love to elevate them, then you're going to bless them. You're going to do something positive. You see, previously you said he did something for them. He led them to war that they needed. Here, in the middle, where he says, I just can't handle you guys, and he gives them a blessing. Instead of, you'll excuse me, swearing at them. I'm just coloring the picture, so to speak. So here again, we see how careful he is. Now, I want to say before we go further, in this theme, it's not easy to do this. At least that's my experience. It's not easy to do this. And that's why we need to make this parsha new, like we started with this story from Rabbi Sacks, you see, to make it new, because every time it's a new effort. Now, let us take a look at, verse 13, he says, you know what? He says, let's make a hierarchy, lower judges, medium-level judges, higher judges, and eventually, the most difficult things will come to me. So now listen to what he says in verse 14. Vatanu oti, you answered me. Vatomri, you said, Tova davar shabarta vasayis. That's a good idea. You said it's a good idea. You might say, okay, that's a very plain sentence. Actually, that's a loaded sentence. Because in the Torah, there's always between the lines, always, always, always between the lines, layers of meaning. And when he is saying a narrative like this, he said, I suggested you have a hierarchy. And you said, great idea. And then he goes on to tell him how to do it. Because in other words, here I am delivering a message straight from God to you. And you know you can't be a faker before me, right? You can't. Because remember, I just want to put this parenthetical important point. Humility does not mean you lie to yourself and say, I'm a terrible person. You know that you're brilliant in whatever it is, and you tell yourself that you're an ignoramus. No, you're not. You're just being silly. You're lying to yourself because whatever, for whatever reason. In other words, Moses knew that he got messages from the Almighty and he delivered it to the Jewish people. He didn't believe that he went up the mountain 40 days, 40 nights. He didn't believe that he, you know, the Ten Commandments, etc., etc. Of course he did. But when he says, you thought it was a good idea, because this way, I'll use these words, when you're dealing with a clerk, you have more wiggle room, right? When you're dealing with lower level judges, maybe you can get away with certain things. So this is, again, it's a rebuke, and it's couched, and it's between the lines. So then it goes on to say, he says, I took the heads of your tribes, well-known wise people, and I placed them as heads of certain multitudes. Turn page 1128. And he says in verse 16, at that time, this is what I told you, that you should judge people. Verse 17, something very, very important. Because this is one of our gifts to the entire world. Lo sekir upon him b'mishpat. You should not recognize one person over the other in judgment. Kakot and kagodol tishmo'on. I'm paraphrasing equality before the law. Right? Equality before the law. Not that we need to hear this from the non-Jewish historians. But all of the famous non-Jewish historians who speak about the Jews list this as one of the gifts of the Jewish people to civilization. When I say civilization, I don't just mean Western civilization. Any civilization that is civil, meaning it's not the rule of the jungle. There's this concept of equality before the law. It comes from right here. Now, I was going to ask a question, and I left it for now because I want you to see how silly the question is. Moshe is giving a narrative, and he's saying, well, I told the judges, this is how you're going to be judges. You're going to have equality before the law. And you could ask, why? Repeat it here. You told the judges, I'm not a judge. Why are you telling it to me? And obviously, that's silly. Because every one of us can learn something about equality before the law. And the best evidence is that it's one of the most recognized contributions of the Jewish people to the world. There are several like this. I have read the introduction and epilogue to Paul Johnson's A History of the Jews many times, so I'm not going to do it again here. I have his book only for the introduction, the epilogue, the middle of the book, which is the book itself, I don't read, because I don't need him to teach me Jewish history with all his mistakes. But this he did get right. He's a world-famous historian, and that's why I have it there, so we can see how a Christian non-Jew who writes about the Jews points out that God is teaching you and me about equality before the law. And when you say equality before the law, I'll paraphrase it this way. So how do I look at somebody who's disheveled? I don't know about anybody else. For me, that's a good question for me to ask myself. And that, as we said at the beginning, that has to be renewed. And then let us go to...
Don't they expand on it today?
So you are very correct. He does expand on it about not taking bribery and so on. He says... And it's expanded further on in the Chumash. And the truth of the matter is, those things are repeated many, many times. But the truth of the matter is, since you mentioned bribery, I'm actually going to dwell on it for a second. Because bribery is not only, I'll pay you $100, you'll make it in my favor. Bribery means, okay, you go to the cook in the yeshiva, let's say, and she's not supposed to give you a cake right now. And you say, oh, you're such a good cook, and this and that and the other. And then you say, can I have a piece of cake? You know that? So these are things that they all relate to us. And of course, we could go through every one of them, but I'm just doing it in general terms. And of course, otherwise, if it didn't relate to all of us, then it should be a separate book for judges. You know, you have certain books, like, for example, the mystical teachings, they were not publicized until a point in history when it was for everybody. But until then, it was only for select people. And the same way this could have been. But if it's here, it means it's for all of us in the manner that I have just mentioned. So we're on the same page. And here we're shifting gears a little, but the same theme. Verse 21. Listen, God gave you the land. Go and inherit it. I'm just saying. Go and inherit it like God has commanded you. Don't be afraid, don't tremble. So now he's saying, you all came to me and you said, let's send out spies. And here's an odd thing. One second. I just told you the story that God said, go take the land, don't be afraid. You say, let's send out spies to scout the land. That should be a negative. What is it saying? Verse 23. I thought it was a good idea. And I took 12 tribes and so on, and he tells that story. Why does he say it's a good idea? Again, Rashi. These are most of the basic comments that I'm putting here are actually straight from Rashi. Why is it a good idea? Because he figured, you know how it is, like you call somebody's bluff, like says, oh, would you really be ready to do that right now? Yeah, go. Let's go do it. When you know that because you're saying yes, they would say, okay, I guess he's not hiding anything. You said, let's send us spies. I said, sure, great idea. Go ahead, do it. In other words, you see that there's no concern, so you didn't have to push forward and actually do the spies. Again, the point is that the rebuke, it's not just telling a story. He's sending the rebuke between the lines. And then let's turn the page where it goes on to say, just a second, verse 23. Now, I'm going to just mention it, and I'm not going to talk about it because Simi's going to talk about that. And you didn't, when the spies came back, you didn't go up. You said, God hates us. Just a second. I tell you what I'm going to do instead of completing even the little thought that I was going to mention, I think the best thing is going to be, is Simi's going to take over, because this is the point that she's on.
So just yesterday I was having a discussion with somebody who knew that we're going through a certain big challenge in our lives. And she said to me, I don't understand, like, why? Why would God do this to you? And of course, you know, it's not an easy discussion. And I said, it's not a question of why would God... You know, there are different things that people have to go through in their lives for whatever reason. I said, you went through this challenge. This person goes through this challenge. This is a challenge that I have to face today. And you don't have to answer, but I'm sure each one of you in your minds goes through, you have different things that you've had to go through in your lives. And sometimes a person will say, well, why? why is God doing this to me? Sometimes the question of why is so that maybe I can learn something and maybe I can figure out what am I supposed to be doing now. Or sometimes, sadly, we say, why me? Like, God, come on, enough, right? Now, of course, whichever way it is, no one can be faulted. At least they're in a discussion with God. That's the first thing. Whether they're saying, why me? Or they're trying to figure out why God is doing it. Maybe I'm supposed to be doing something as a result. This is, as long as we keep the discussion going with God and hopefully arrive at the right place. So I'm not bringing this point up in order to criticize. I'm just bringing it up as a point as it relates to Parsha Devarim. In perhaps the most mass performance review ever, Moshe Rabbeinu, as the rabbi said, is going through the various challenges with the Jewish people throughout his history with them. Is it on the last day of his life?
In the last week
of his life, I believe, possibly the last day. He's going through and reviewing before he bids farewell to the Jewish people, and he is correcting certain things. He's putting out the review and saying, perhaps it should have been done this way, perhaps it should have done that way. Let's go through history and let's make sure we have everything correct and that we've learned whatever lessons there are to be learned through the mistakes we've made throughout these years that I've been your leader. And so as the rabbi got to this point of the spies and how the Jews reacted after the Chet HaMeraglim, after the sin of the spies, after the spies came and told this horrible report about the land of Israel, the Jewish people were nervous, they were in fear, and they complained. And he says, we're talking right now, page 1130, 1131, right on the top. And it says, but you did not want to go up to the land. You rebelled against the word of God, your God. You spoke slanderously in your tents. You said, God took us out of the land of Egypt because he hates us. Because he hates us. Those are quite strong words. It's like saying, God, it's like a setup. Right from the beginning, you took us out from the furnace into the fire. How does it go?
Frying pan into fire.
Either way, I mean, it was bad enough what we had in Egypt, but you took us right into the hands of the enemy who were for sure going to kill us. There's nothing, you know, it's terrible. God, what kind of a setup did you make over there? And now the question is, when we look at this and Moshe's reviewing, it's easy for us to judge in hindsight. But if we look at this and we say, did they have a right to protest like that? What was the underlying cause? What was the underlying thing going on when the Jewish people said, hey, God hates us? You ever had it that one of your children came home from school and said, my teacher hates me? My teacher hates me. She never calls on me, or she always picks on me, or whatever the thing is. My teacher hates me. Or sometimes you yourself, they must hate me. But the question is, when the child is saying this to you, my teacher hates me, what's really underlying there? What are they really saying? They're nervous. Maybe the teacher doesn't love me enough, right? Doesn't care about me. She's choosing everyone else. Or whatever she's doing because she really doesn't care. I'm just like I'm a nobody in her eyes. It's a nervousness. It's something that the child is worried about. And so we, of course, have to listen and try to reflect and all the different things that we're taught to do when a child comes with that kind of thing. And when the Jewish people are saying it's because he hates us, if you look into the situation, perhaps they think, does God really love us? If he really loved us, is this what would happen? I want to give a little story. I may have some of the details incorrect, but the basic story is the same. Story my father used to tell about a yeshuvnik, like a farmer guy who basically worked the land, Jewish guy, Jewish peasant. And a holy man was traveling and ended up being stuck in his region and ended up asking if he could stay in their home. And so they said, okay, it's a holy man. In this home, the wife wore the pants, it sounds like, and she decided things. She says, okay, I'll take him in. That's fine. They gave him a bedroom on one of the top floors. But the wife says, you know, when we go out to the farms, you know, we lock the door, because he's not going anywhere anyway. So let's just keep the rest of the house safe. She didn't really know who this man was. And I guess there was some terrible storms. And so the man had to, I don't know if it was a tzaddik, it was a great man who was staying in their home. And they gave him lodging, they gave him boarding, but they went out to work. And then at night, they were in their home, and it was late at night, and the woman heard
the rabbi was crying in his room. He was crying. And she's like, she couldn't take it. What's he crying about? You know, she says to her husband, what's he crying about? You know, he's here in our home. We're giving him lodging. We're giving him board. I guess they sent him up some food. Oh, what's he crying about? And she's thinking, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Maybe it's that he doesn't like the door being locked. Okay, we'll unlock it. And next night, again, she hears him crying. And she hears him crying. She says, what's he crying about? We already unlocked the door. What else could it be? We're giving him a room. We're giving him board. What's it? Maybe he's hungry. Fine. She sends up with her husband some food. He should have food to eat. Next night, again, he's crying. What's he crying about? And she's thinking, what else could he be? Maybe probably misses his family. Every night she's trying to think of something he's crying about. And finally the wife said, it's enough already. What's he crying? Every night, we're being so nice. He's staying here in our home, whether he was giving some money or not, I don't know. But so the husband went up and says, you know, we don't understand. Every night you're crying. Late at night, you're crying and you're crying, you're crying. We tried, we unlocked the door, we send you food, we try to make sure that you're comfortable. What's going on? And so he says, well, I'm really sorry that I worried you. It has nothing to do with you. It's not your fault. I want to tell you what my crying is about. We have a Jewish long-time custom. It's actually in the Code of Jewish Law. That late at night, we cry, we say certain prayers because of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. These were not very learned people, so he explained how it used to be, that we had our homeland, we had our Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish people lived in such glory, we had a beautiful temple, we'd go there to pray, we'd go to this to serve God. But he was trying to, and he saw that the peasant man didn't really understand all this glory, this beauty of the Beit HaMikdash. So he tried to explain it to him in his terms, and he said, imagine living in a place, in a place with full peace, where you didn't have any of these different Kazakhs, you didn't have the Kazakhs who were coming, and or you didn't have the lords who were standing over you and treating you, mistreating you so terribly, and you didn't have all these terrible pogroms against Jews. Imagine such life. That they could understand, because they had been on the receiving end of terrible pogroms through the years, terrible mistreatment from the paritzim. He says, imagine such a life where you had none of that. It was totally peaceful. It was totally perfect. Imagine such a life. So we have this custom. We go late at night. We cry for the Chorban Beit HaMikdash. And some of us sit on the floor. We rent our clothes. It's a very, very spiritual, uplifting time. And I'm crying, not about you, not about anything you did. I'm crying about the Holy Temple, and we want God to take us back to his land already. And so the husband comes down and explains to the wife that it's not their fault. It's all, and this is what he's crying about, and it's about the Chorban Beit HaMikdash. And she says, okay, I hear it. She said, she was in charge. She says, I hear it. It makes sense. She says, but I think I have a different idea. Let God take, you heard this from me once before, let God take the Kazakhs, the Paritzim, all of these people, let him take them to Israel and leave us here, and we'll have peace and prosperity. We have our farm. We have cows. We have milk. What do we need? It's fine. Let him take them to Israel, and we'll all live in peace, right? The story is basically accurate, except for a few little adjustments. But the point is, Jewish people here were saying, God hates us because he took us out of Egypt. Why didn't he just leave us in the fertile crescent of the Nile?
Yeah.
And we could have, Egypt was a very fertile land. We could have stayed there. And he could have taken the Egyptians out. We had to go to be smitten by the Amori. We had to go and fight our way back into our land. There was so much that the Jewish people had to go through before they actually were able to be Yoshvim Betach, to be sitting in Eretz Yisrael, Ish Tachat Gafnov, Ish Tachat Te'inato, under his vineyard and his fig tree, etc. What is it? God must hate us. So when we listen to this, we listen with a compassionate heart, and we see maybe did the Jews have some sort of a... Was it right for them to feel so insecure, to feel, look? I mean, after what the spies had told them, they really scared them. They really put the fear of going into the land of Israel in their heart. And Jewish people, maybe it's right that they said, you know what? It does feel like God doesn't love us. This is love? This is what love looks like? There's a woman by the name of Hannah Pellberger. She tells about her husband who lived in was a small child, and he was in the DP camps after World War II. The DP camps was basically taking a concentration camp and moving it up a little bit to make it a little bit more habitable, and that's where they were staying until there were better arrangements made. So he's living there with barbed wire still around him, and he heard, this was in Germany, and he hears them saying things like, you know, would have been better for Germany to win the war, right? And he's thinking, he's living in this kind of a condition. He's saying, this is what winning looks like. I mean, the Germans are out there still, whoever's left, and the Poles are all out there, and they're living the good life. And we're living here behind barbed wire in this upgraded concentration camp. You know, this kind of upgrade nobody needs. This is what winning looks like. Who needs this kind of winning? Which is what the Jews were saying. Like, this is what winning, this is what love looks like. God taking us out of Egypt like this. Some of you who were here Shabbos heard me telling, so I'll just summarize, about the bris that took place clandestinely in Russia, where even the mohel had to be blindfolded and brought into the place where the Brit Milah was going to be taking place, because it had to be done in a way that even the mohel wouldn't know where he was, and he could never give the address so that these people would be taken in by the KGB, etc. And when the mohel reached the point in the prayers where he said, just as this boy has entered the covenant, so shall he enter Torah, chuppah, and maisim tovim, and good deeds, the Torah and the marriage canopy and performance of mitzvot. And when he finished saying those words, the people looked at him in horror and they said, Rabbi, you cursed us. And he was like, what? He says, this is the kind of feeling that we should be entering the rest of our life, that he should be entering the Torah and the marriage canopy and performance of good deeds in such trepidation for his life. Is this what it is to have to be going through such challenges? One more point before we bring this all together. You know, some people have a custom to bless their children Friday night, bless them to be boys like Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, girls to be like Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And you think about it, think about the lives of Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Was it so easy? Think of each one of them, most of them barren, right? Except for Leah, right? They were barren. They had to work so hard to achieve whatever it was they wanted. Sarah, let's just think of Sarah with Hagar. Sarah, who had Rivka, who had her brother Lavan, her father. We can go through each one. I mean, this is not a place to go through those stories, but we're all familiar. Each one of our matriarchs and our patriarchs had terrible, terrible challenges. So what are we blessing them with? And again, this, of course, comes back to a point which we've learned in many different ways. But here, this week's parsha is a great time to emphasize the point again. What does it mean when we're blessing someone? Is the ultimate blessing of an easy life, or is the blessing of a meaningful life? So when we say, God, you gave me this, that means you hated me. Is that what it means? You know, you look at parents who have children who they feel these children can be motivated and to become so great. Those parents usually work much, much harder, right? They get up early in the morning. You see these kids, whether it's the field that they're pushing them into, or athletics or politics or whatever it is, any part of this child's rearing and any part of his education is going to be much harder. It's going to be more challenging for the kids and more challenging for the parents because they're pushing them to become something, to have a meaningful life, to have a life where they are accomplishing. And this is what God is doing here. God is saying, yes, it's true. Going out of Egypt and making your way to the promised land is not easy. But who said the easy life is the best life? Who says that the straight road that is so paved, so well paved with no bumps, is the best life? It's the easy choice. That doesn't mean it's the best choice. And this is why Moshe, when he's reviewing with the Jewish people where they went wrong, what we need to correct, what we can learn from it, he is saying to them that it was erroneous, what you did there, to doubt God and to say, God, it means you hated us? There was a problem in that. Because truthfully, it wasn't that God hates us. What it means is God expected the best for us, wanted the best for us. And in order for us to become the best, in order for gold to become pure gold, it goes through the fire. In order for diamonds to be cleaned off, there's a lot of scraping away.
And I'm sure each one of you can think in your life, things that you wanted to achieve that brought you to the next level, they usually came through hardship. I know in our lives we think about that, different things that we've achieved, different things that were hard, it came through challenges. That's the way it is. Anything that is an achievement does not usually come just from showing up every day to the day, whenever it is. You know, like Zig Ziglar used to say, do you want to become are you a wandering generality or a meaningful specific? Like he says, imagine I don't know if you can remember the name, some great achiever in business, he said, imagine you asked him, or some great athlete, he says, well, how did you become that way? And he says, well, I just showed up, you know?
Right. CEO of General Motors.
Oh. Yeah. How did you become that? I just showed up. He said, it doesn't work that way. It means you got up, and you got up earlier than everyone else. You went to sleep later than everyone else. You worked harder than everyone else. Then you became. And so this is what God wants of us, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, my child, my eldest, my favorite, whatever it is, however you want to term. He expected more from us, and therefore we had a challenging road, and we still have a challenging road to get to that point. And ultimately, God willing, it will happen soon that we actually get to that time when we can sit under our gafno and te'inato, under our tree. But it comes through perseverance, because God wants us to have this meaningful life. I just want to make sure that I remember when I lost a lot of weight when I lived in Texas. And I didn't just lose it because the fat doesn't just melt away because it's hot weather. But what I did was I would get up in weather that's much, much hotter than this, and I would keep walking, and I would just tell myself, it's cool. Like, it's cool. I'm getting there. And, you know, it was the kind of weather that you didn't want to be walking. You're nuts to walk in that kind of weather, or whatever else I was doing. And you each know on your own challenges that to get to whatever promised land it is, it takes a lot of effort. The Kutzker Rebbe was famous for saying, there is nothing more whole than a broken heart. But don't worry, that's how the light gets in, right? It takes work. It definitely takes a lot of work. And sadly, through the ages, we've gone through a lot of suffering, we've gone through a lot of challenges. And hopefully, God willing, we're getting to that point where we realize it's out of God's love for us, not out of his hate for us, and that we're going to be at that point where all of that, all suffering and all challenges will be ended.
I do want to just take the last few minutes, not close just yet, because this dovetails perfectly with one of the elements that I had prepared and very relevant. If you could just take a look on page 1131, in which it really continues on this very theme, and take a look at what it says. In verse 31, ובמדבר אשר איש אשר נשאך השם לקחו, in the desert you saw how God took care of your every need until this point, I'm paraphrasing. And then it goes on to say, however, in 32, but in this particular point, you don't believe in God in this particular point, even though verse 33, he's showing you the way, he's taking care of you, and so on and so forth. So what I'd like to say is that in this narrative, which of course has the rebuke, and it's softened, but it's pointed. Every one of us, we could look at all sorts of things and see how God has been there for us. And I guess the longer you go through life, the more examples a person has. And then you have certain moments, and like Simi was saying right at the beginning, and you say, why me? So God is saying, wait a second. Everything that's good, you understood why you understand. But now, you know why this is. But there's a very interesting word here. It says, "Dover Hazeh," which is in verse 32. In this particular point, you don't believe in God. I'd like to say that our son-in-law's uncle, Binyamin Gordon, his name was Yeshua Binyamin Gordon, and he was a shaliach to somewhere in California, wherever it was, and he has told this story many, many times. Encino, California. He once had a tremendously difficult situation to deal with. He writes to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe says to him, and he says that he's lived with these words, and actually since his passing, somebody actually made a song which became popular with these words. The Rebbe says to him that he should work mitoich meretz,
He should work very energetically. In other words, work very, very hard. That's the simple meaning of merits. Ubitachen chazak, and strong trust in God. Now, I'll be honest with you. When I was younger, and I would hear things like this, how is trust going to help you? Okay, I'm not that young now, but I used to be that young. And I'd like to say how it does help you. Because what is the meaning of trust? The meaning of trust is, I know that God has a plan for the good. Happens to be, I just want to be theological and theocratical just for a short moment, happens to be we live in a time of past, present, and future. God is not limited by past, present, and future. So just because in our realm it'll take, I don't know, 17 years for something to develop, in God's realm it's already developed. Okay, but the thing is that if there's trust that God has a plan for the good, one of the things it does for us is it allows us to shrug off the albatross from our shoulders, the heavyweight from our shoulders. Even though that's not the only reason for personal benefit, but as a matter of actual fact, that's what trust does. When it comes to certain situations, and it hurts. Now, I have to say something. I listened to a class by Shaystab just last week. I think it was last week, maybe the week before. He said some words, and they're irritating me. Not because I disagree with them, but because I cannot disagree with them. So it's causing me introspectively, it's causing me agitation. He says, what's the difference between pain and suffering? Pain, it's only natural. If something hurts, you go, ouch. You step on something that's sharp, and you go, ouch. That's called pain, and that's okay. But if you keep obsessing with it afterwards, that's already suffering. Why did I have to suffer? Why did I have to step on that bit? Why did somebody leave this over here? Couldn't they be more, right? So that's suffering, which is actually a result of personal obsession. So as I say, I'm just being open book. I'm still in the process of having an inner struggle on this subject, because this is the point here. God says, hey, listen, I did all these things. Now you have this difficulty. And then this difficulty, you say, God, you don't like me today. You know, just on this particular point. And I want to conclude with something that I have told many times before and probably will tell it many times, because I believe that this is really comes to the key point. When our son had a life-threatening disease, so one of the people who could speak our language was my brother, because he had struggled for his wife's survival of a much more severe form of that disease, 3.5 years, and she didn't make it, unfortunately. I asked him a question, though I knew exactly what his reaction was going to be in advance. I asked him, did you ever have any doubts? Now, in Hebrew, when you say, in Yiddish, using Hebrew, did you ever have any svekas? It automatically means doubts in your trust in God. And he said exactly what I knew he was going to say. He said, of course not. Why would you even ask me such a question? And I told him that I knew you were going to say that. The reason I'm asking you this question is because I meet people who don't necessarily live that way, and I want to be able to tell them that somebody who has gone through as much Gehenna, as much hell as you have, and it wasn't even a question of trust in the Almighty. That's exactly what I told him. And I, as I stand before you here today, and as you've heard me say this before, in our situation, I tell you straight, that our situation strengthened my trust in God, not only for the duration, but I am still benefiting from it today. And again, to add to what Simi was, to a nuance to what Simi was saying, I would never wish it on myself or anybody else to go through that cauldron of refinement to reach such a point. But I don't want to give up the spiritual benefit that came to me by going through that cauldron. So why did God choose me amongst my family? I'm only speaking about myself because I don't want to speak for other people. So I'm speaking for myself and I'm opening myself up. So for myself, I say, why did God choose me to take me through this cauldron in order to gift me? And that's how I view it, to gift me with trust in him that helps me walk every single day in his path? I have no idea. And it's very simple why I have no idea.
Because God's a little brighter than me, if you know what I mean, a little smarter, a little bigger than me. And if I understood God's ways, then I guess I would be God. And since I'm not God, so I accept that I don't understand everything. So coming back to the point here, that here is part of the rebuke when he sticks in, God is doing this, right? You have feet, you could walk. You have hands, you can move. And I, again, thank God, I'm sorry for repeating this again. Some years ago, I slipped, I broke my left arm. And I'm saying this because this is a gift from God. This is not by my own efforts. While I'm on the floor and I'm in that pain, I didn't know the arm was broken until after Shabbos. And this happened, I think it was Thursday night. Or Friday morning, whatever one it was. Anyway, I said to myself, I want to remember the pain so I can thank God that I have a left arm. Right? So this is the soft but pointed rebuke that we can intake. And as Rabbi Sacks said, I'll say it again, at the very beginning, we need to make it fresh and new every single day. Yeah, thank you. Shkach to you. Your piece is beautiful. Shkach. I just want to tell you, how did I know what my brother was going to answer? And of course, it's exactly what he said. How did I know? Because when, and I'm going to use the word in English because I don't know of another word, because when a person is walking through hell, that's not a good time to start discovering philosophical ideas, theological ideas, and making sense of the world. Because at that point in time, you're squeezed in such a place that your brain cannot think without the heart shoving it out of the way. Okay? What really needs to happen to the thinking person, because all human beings, we're thinking people, is that when things are okay, relatively speaking, that's the time when we learn passages like this, and we have classes like this, and we strengthen these ideas, that's called insurance. Because when you do that enough, you get to a point that I know, on some level at least, the kind of hell my brother did go through with his wife, with kids who lost a mother, and so on. And I knew for sure exactly what he's going to say. And he said basically word for word what I knew he was going to say. How did I know? Because I knew that these ideas were cultivated in his mind for years and years before. And that's, again, the idea of every year we're going through this parasha. We need to cultivate these ideas. Now, having said that we need to cultivate these ideas, I want to again tell another story, which has been a while since I told it, but it's worthwhile. I was once in another, not in British Columbia, let's just say it that way, doing a bris for a particular family. This was shortly after our son got a free bill of health, which means that my head was still in that place, just right in there. So the grandfather of this baby, while everybody's in there, you know, the food and so on, and I'm in the shoulder doing my clear, he's schmoozing to me, he starts telling me as follows. He says that his wife, she got that particular type of cancer, which is what my sister-in-law, Alain Shalom, had. And he says that she became much more believing, got much more into the religion on account of it. He says, but not me. And essentially, to wrap up what he said, there's a little poem in English. Humpty Dumpty sat in the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great big fall. All the king's horses, all the king's men could not put Humpty Dumpty back together again. In other words, he was crying, literally, his husband, to me, about his wife's illness. She had now recovered. She had looked for God and found God through this disease. He had not. And he was broken to pieces and expressing to me how he couldn't put any of the pieces back together again. It's like he had been driven straight into a brick wall. The pieces were on the floor. Who could pick them up? The reason I say this, because even though it is true that ideally if a person sets up their mindset when things are good, it is possible, and that's why I use a real living example of someone who did it, the patient herself, that while she had this disease, she went searching for God to see if maybe that could help or be a balm for her, B-A-L-M. And that's what she found. And the husband who didn't, he's broken to pieces and he can't glue himself together again. Right?
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.